Yes.
Okay, good, good.
Okay, this morning we have Mr. Wendell Lawrence, who would be presenting on the topic Fundamentals of Economic Analysis and Evaluating Government Securities. Mr. Lawrence, welcome.
Thank you very much. I just let this turn on the air condition, sorry. yeah, it's a pleasure. Are you the same group I met yesterday?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so there's no need for an introduction then.
Right.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Daniel, or Mrs. Daniel.
Yes.
Daniel. Today, we'll be focusing on economic analysis and evaluating government securities. The economic analysis that we will look at is specifically related to government securities. How do you evaluate an economy and make a judgment as to whether or not government securities are safe and to whether or not you should invest in those securities? So that we will start by evaluating governments, showing how to evaluate government securities, and then we'll go in more details in the economic analysis that you'll do to help you in evaluating government securities. So this is the presentation overview. I will start looking at the nature of government securities, sources and information for evaluating government securities, the rating of government securities, government operations, the economy's impact on the securities market, economic indicators, and these economic indicators will help you to assess the economic activity, evaluate government's position, evaluate sovereign debt. So we will first have a look at evaluating government securities. I think the major issue you'll be concerned about at this stage is what are government securities? And I know you would have covered some of it in some of your earlier presentation, but just to ensure that we are on the same page, government securities are essentially obligations by the government to pay investors a fixed amount at some future time and to pay interest in the interim. And the two major types of government securities are bonds and treasury bills. There are others, there are government notes, etc. But these are the types that are traded mainly in our markets in the Eastern Caribbean. One of the major differences is that government bonds tend to be longer term, treasury bills tend to be shorter term, 90, under a year. Another important aspect of government securities is that they have fixed interest rates. This means that once you issue your bond and you say it has a nominal value of $100 with an interest rate of 10%, then that interest rate remains fixed throughout the life of the bond. So it would be, so you would get 10% of $110 throughout the life of the bond. What will change though, from time to time, sometimes, is the price of the bond, and we'll explain that in a little more detail. The other important feature is the maturity of the bond, and every bond says when it matures. And that's one of the beauty of government securities or of bonds as distinct from stocks. If everything goes badly and the price is going down, you can wait it out because they have a maturity date. If they are 20 years bond, at the end of 20 years, you'll get back the $100 that you invested so that you'd suffer losses when you seek to sell or trade the bond in the interim. But if things really got bad, you can actually wait out the maturity period. I put a term duration there, and I'm going to discuss duration in a little more detail because duration is different from maturity, and duration is a very important tool in terms of evaluating government securities or evaluating any type of securities. Currencies in the Eastern Caribbean, most of the governments tend to issue bonds in EC dollars, but there's no reason, for example, if you're funding a project that has significant amount of imports, there's no reason for you not to issue bonds in US dollars if you want. The thing is, though, because we have a central bank that manages our reserves, the government sometimes is not so focused on actually raising funds in US, because if they raise it in EC, then whatever US resources they need, they will get it from the central bank on an ongoing basis. But if you're in a different type of country, say Barbados now, where foreign reserves is a challenge, and you have a major project that will require a significant amount of imports from overseas, and so that you'll need US dollars to buy the imports, you may find it advantageous under those circumstances to issue bonds denominated in US dollars. Government bonds generally, especially in our parts, do not have collateral for that. Whereas in some bonds you have, they may have a guarantee, the government itself may guarantee, and sometimes that guarantee is automatic. Every time there's a government bond, the governments of the Caribbean can only raise money in this way by legislation. Some of them would pass legislation every time they need to raise a bond, so that legislation would give them the authority to raise the bond. Some of them have an umbrella piece of legislation that allows them to raise a certain amount of bonds and treasury bills within certain limits, so that it is every time a government raises bonds, it has to be in accordance with the legislation. And for you who are evaluating bonds, it is very important that you see and familiarize yourself with that legislation to ensure that there's authority for the issuance of the bond. Because if there are no authority for the issuance of the bond, it could get legally very complex for you to recover your money subsequently. So that's a very important point. It just came up, by the way, so it's not in the slide, but you need to remember it. Because there is no collateral, that issued usually with the full faith and credit of the government. It means it is backed by the government. There was a time when people used to say that government bonds are risk-free, in the sense that the risk of default is zero. That has changed, in the sense that some governments, including St. Kitts and Nevis, including Grenada, including a number of other including some very big governments around the world, they have defaulted. And so that whole notion that a sovereign security is always risk-free has been dismantled. And so that you have to carry out the same type of analysis that you'd carry out for any other type of securities. Government securities are subject to a whole range of risks. They are subject to inflation risk, interest rate risk, and default risk. And we'll go to these risks in a little more detail. But the inflation risk is very easy to understand, because imagine you invest $100,000 with the government, you're getting a rate of 5%. You're not going to get the $100,000 until 20 years, but every year you get a 5% interest rate. But the inflation rate is 7%. It means the inflation rate is higher than the interest that you are getting. So at the end of the period, even though you get back the $100,000 that you had invested, it doesn't have the same purchasing power that it had when you initially invested it, because the amount of goods it can buy would have dwindled very substantially, because prices have gone up so substantially. So that inflation risk is a very significant risk. Whenever you're going to evaluate a bond, and you're going to decide whether to invest in a bond, you will have to make sure that the interest rate is sufficient to compensate you for the loss of purchasing power you will have as a result of inflation. So it also means that you have to make a judgment, an assessment, a prediction as to how inflation will behave over the period over the investment horizon. And then we have interest rate risk and default risk. To discuss interest rate risk in greater detail, I'm going to discuss the concept of bond duration. I know you all have been attending a number of other courses. Have you covered bond duration in any other course?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay. One of the fundamental characteristic of a bond is that bond prices goes up and down with changes in the interest rate. And it goes up and down inversely. In other words, if interest rates go up, bond prices will go down. If interest rate goes down, bond prices will go up. And why is this so? And just think of it, forget the theory, and think of it from a practical and logical standpoint. Imagine the government, you have a $1,000 bond, and the government is paying you 10% for it. So you're happy every year, you get $100 from your bond. But imagine interest rate goes up now. So interest rate is now 15%. So that new bonds are being issued where people are getting 15%. Then what happens to your bond? Your bond becomes less valuable. If you try to sell your bond to anybody else, would they be interested in buying bond under those circumstances? They would prefer to buy the bonds at the new interest rate of 15%. And so that if you want to get your bond sold, your $1,000 bond sold, you will have to reduce the price to a level that when an investor invests, he's now getting 15% of whatever price he paid, so that the price will have to go down. So that if general interest rates are going up and you have a bond with a fixed rate of interest at 10%, then for you to get that bond sold, you will have to sell it. You will have to sell it at a discount, a significant discount. And the reverse is true. If you are getting 10% for your bond, when your bond was issued, you got a par value, you got a nominal rate of interest of 10%. And all of a sudden, interest rate all over the economy has gone down to 5%, and new bonds are being issued at 5%. Then all of a sudden, because you're getting 10% and everybody is only getting 5%, your bond look attractive, and so the price goes up, which means that as interest rate goes down, the price of bonds goes up. Everybody understand the underlying logic of what I just said there? If you don't understand at any point, please stop me. Just say I don't understand. Now, what is duration then? Duration is not the same as maturity. It is expressed in number of years, but it is not the same as maturity. It is different. It's a far more complicated process. Duration is a measure of the bond sensitivity to changes in interest rate. So that when you know the bond duration, and if you are able to tell, for example, a bond with a very high duration, for example, if you say a bond with a duration of 10 years, would have high sensitivity to interest rate changes. So that even very small changes in interest rates will have a big drop. If you have a small increase in interest rate, it will have a big drop in the price of the bond. Whereas if you have a duration of just 1 year, the bond price will still be affected by interest rate, but a small change in interest rate would only create a small change in the price of the bond. So that if you want to be absolutely secure, if you want to protect yourself against those changes in price because of changes of in interest rate, what sort of duration bonds would you buy? Would you buy Would you buy high duration bonds or low duration bonds?
Low.
You buy low. Anybody disagrees? Yes, because a low duration bond have very, very little sensitivity to changes in interest rate. The thing though is that interest rate and risk and return, it is, are you seeing me? You hearing me? You say my internet is unstable. I hope I don't lose you, but you're hearing me. Okay. The duration of a bond, I'm saying, if you, but risk and return are opposite sides of the same coin. So that if you buy a low duration bond because you don't want to take the risk, then you very likely, under normal circumstances, that the rate of return that you will get will be a little lower than somebody who are prepared to take the risk of a longer duration bond. The thing is that it doesn't work like that, because later on you'll see that the yield curve sometimes shifts, and we will discuss what the yield curve is as we go on. Duration, and this is another simple way of calculating duration, of looking at duration. It is a measure of how long it takes in years for investors to be repaid the price of the bond. Now, don't get confused though. It seems very simple here, because if you would say, look, if I'm getting $10 every year and I buy a bond for $100, then $10 every year would, in 10 years, I would have recovered the bond. Give me 1 second. So you would say, in 10 years, I would have recovered the bond. That is not duration, because duration is focused on the present value of the cash flow. So that $10 that you're getting every year would have to be discounted to its present value for you to calculate the duration. The duration formula is really very complicated. And usually, when you get a bond, or when you read the literature in relation to bonds, it is calculated for you. If you have a good financial calculator, you just put in the numbers and it will give you duration. But it is a complex, not so complex, but you know, it takes a little time to calculate it. But you don't have to worry. At this level, you will not be asked in an exam how to calculate duration. But you will certainly be asked to interpret it. What does it mean? So the duration measures how long it takes for investors to be repaid the price of the bond. For zero coupon bonds, duration equals maturity. And that is easy to understand. What is a zero coupon bond? Everybody knows what is a zero coupon bond? Cassandra?
There's no coupons, but it's sold at a discount.
That's correct. What happens really is that you don't have any coupons, so that you're investing it at $95. At the end of 10 years, you get back $100. So during the interim, you get no interest rate. So because of that, the bond, you will not get back the full amount for the bond until the 10 years up, if it is a 10-year maturity bond. So that the duration would be exactly equal to the maturity if it is a zero coupon bond. Is that clear?
Yeah.
The longer...
Sorry, could you say that one more time?
Okay, good. I was saying, a zero coupon bond, the regular bond, every year you get the interest. You understand that, right? A zero coupon bond, and the interest is called the coupon, because the coupon tells you how much interest. So if you have a bond with a coupon of 10%, it means you're going to get 10% every year. So a zero coupon bond means you get 0% every year. So for a zero coupon bond, the bond might have a face value of $100, so that you pay $90 for that bond in year one. But you're not going to get any interest at all until the end of year 10 when the bond matures. And when the bond matures, you get $100. And so the difference between what you paid for it and what you get at the end represents your profit on the bond or your interest on the bond. The point is, though, remember I said earlier that duration tells you how long it takes for you to get back what you invested in the bond. In the case of a zero coupon bond, because no payment is made to you until the maturity date, then what it means is that the duration would be equal to maturity in the case of zero coupon bonds, because they have no way you could be repaid the purchase price of the bond until the end of the maturity period, until the end of the investment horizon. Whereas with other bonds, because you get interest continuously throughout the year, the duration would be less, because there might be, after about 6 or 7 years, you might have had enough money to pay you for what you paid for the bond, and the balance would be profits afterwards. Is that clear?
Yes.
Okay. The long, but although duration don't always equal to maturity, there's a relationship. If you have the longer the maturity of the bond, then the higher would be the duration. You need to remember these relationships because they could be tested in an exam. This could come as a multiple choice, and you could ask the longer the maturity, the duration of the bond, the longer the maturity, the higher the duration. So that, and you would have to decide which one is correct. So that you need to be very careful to these relationships. The higher the coupon rate, the lower the duration. If you have a high coupon rate, it means you are getting high interest every year. Is that clear?
Yes.
So that would mean that you would recover your investment much more quickly. So that you could understand that the higher the coupon rate, the lower the duration. As interest increases, duration decreases. As interest rate increases, the duration decreases. And again, that's a very, very similar notion. These are concepts that you need to be aware of and remember them when you're preparing for the exam. Go through them and make sure you understand what duration is about and what is the relationship to duration to all of these. Sources of information on government securities. So that you are trying to decide to invest in government securities, or alternatively, you have invested in government securities and you're trying to decide whether you should hold them or sell them. Where would you get information? You probably just want to know how safe is your investment. Is this government doing well? Should I continue to hold the security? Where would you get that information? I've listed some of them. Every year, the government must present annual accounts. There's also a director of audit report that reports on their annual accounts, whether or not the accounts are presented clearly and accurately. The budget address is a very important source of information because it not only tells you how the government or how the economy has performed, it also tells you what future plans the government has in mind. The government statistical departments have a range of information about your balance of payments, about price, etc. And later on in this presentation, you'll see how you use that type of information. The ECCB have a range of publications, and if you go on the ECCB site, you will see a whole lot of statistical information for the Eastern Caribbean Currency Union as a whole and for each of the individual countries. Then you have a number of regional and international bodies that publish information from time to time. CDB is among the regional bodies, and the World Bank and the IMF. The IMF conducts an Article 4 consultation for every country every year. And so once they have concluded the Article 4 country consultation, they would have discussed with the government, they would have discussed with the private sector, they would have collected data, and they would make an assessment of the economy, and they would usually publish it. Of course, they need the permission of the government to publish it, but in most cases, it is published. Then ministers make speeches from time to time, and you listen to those speeches again, that gives you a sense of the direction that the government is taking, and whether or not, if they come with some fancy projects, you begin to wonder how will this affect the government finances in the future? Is this too expensive? Would they have problem being able to service that loan because of this fancy project? So that these are things you need to know. Of course, the government accounts have significant limitations. One of them is that they are not prepared on an accrual basis. They are not prepared in accordance with international financial standards. They are usually prepared on a cash basis, which has very, very significant limitations in terms of how you use them and how you interpret them. But as we go through the course, I will show you some other information where you could get some other information on how, what sort of interpretation that you could make. What is good in the government accounts, though, is that the auditor tells you something is radically wrong with the government itself, and it has some significant governance risk affecting the account and affecting the likelihood that the government would be able to pay its debts. The rating of government securities. This is very useful because one of the things that the rating focuses on is default. What is the risk of default? So that you have various rating agencies around the world, Moody, you have S&P, Standard & Poor's, and they rate securities. So they may say this is an AAA security, which means it's a very high quality security and the risk of default is high. So the focus of a rating is on the credit quality and on the risk of default. They have various rating systems. The letter grades used in bond ratings is usually, and this is S&P, AAA would be very, very high quality. Then you have AA, then you have BB, BBB, BB. Now, where I draw the line, is where these are considered investment grade securities. Beyond the line, if a security have these ratings, they will be considered junk securities, at least very speculative securities. What I suggest you do is that you actually look up Standard & Poor's, or just look a bond rating and see how the rating system goes, what AA mean, what BB mean, for yourself. Do that little research for yourself, because you could have exam questions that ask you what does BB mean or what does AA mean, so that you need to do that little research for yourself. When I say you could, it doesn't mean you would, but I'm saying that is certainly within that sphere play in the context of this course. The limitations of ratings. Ratings have had a lot of negatives in recently. And one of the most important reasons for that is the 2008 financial crisis. A lot of banks and financial institutions defaulted, and the ratings, and even some of them even had AAA ratings. And so people say, well, doesn't this rating, we pay so much and we put so much emphasis on these ratings, but they seem inaccurate. But the ratings themselves have certain limitations. One of them is that a rating is an opinion. It is not a statement of fact. It depends on facts. They collect as much facts as they could about the organization. But at the end of the day, they have to make an opinion. They cannot say with any definitiveness that this bond will not default or this issue will not default. The second thing is that ratings are relative in the sense that it tells you that a AAA bond is better credit quality than a BBB bond. But it does not tell you in absolute terms that a AAA bond has only a 1% chance of default, whereas a BBB has a 5 or 10% chance of default. It is relative. What the only statement it is making is that a AAA bond has a better quality than a BBB bond. The other thing is it is expressed in likelihood. It is not, as again, it is based on probabilities. It is certainly not based on any definitive or absolute values. It is static in the sense that when you do a rating, it is as of today, but circumstances could change next week, next month, that could affect the ability of the issuer to pay. The thing though is that most bond agencies do revise their ratings every year. But even within a year, there is a chance that something could happen that could affect the credibility of the issuer. And thirdly, the bond rating is not an audit. It is as good as the financial information that is given to them. So they do not audit the financial information. The audit is done by the firm's external and internal auditors. So that the fact that the bond rating, the bond agency reports some data doesn't mean that you can rely on it, because who you will be relying on is the director of the auditor who would have audited the information provided to the bond rating agency. Bond rating in the Caribbean is catching on, but it has not fully catched on. And that is why we have to do a course of this nature, because if there is no rating, then you trying to invest in a bond, I think it's an EBIS bond or any type of bond, will have to do an assessment for yourself as to the credit quality and as to the risk of default. In the Caribbean, the major rating agency is CariCris. And it is important to know how CariCris would be different from, say, a Standard & Poor's rating. And this is based on the whole concept of relativity, in the sense that I said before that bond ratings are relative. It says A is better than B. Now, in CariC, for example, in those international bond ratings, it is saying a AAA will be some of the best firms in the world. Or if it is a US rating, if it's not a global rating, a US rating, a AAA firm would tell you that is the best quality bond in the US. Similar to when CariCris gives a rating and say it is AAA, it might be that is saying that that is the best credit rating in the Caribbean. It is the best among Caribbean countries. And that is very important, because if that same entity that got a AAA from CariCris went and did a Standard & Poor's, it might actually get a much lower rating simply because of the fact that now the comparison is with companies all over the globe. Is that clear? You can also, CariCris also do national ratings, so that you could have a national rating in a place like Jamaica, where the set of companies from which comparators are taken is all the companies nationally. So if you get a AAA, that AAA rating is means that you're among the best quality in Jamaica, not the best quality in the region. So that it is important too that when you read ratings, you understand what they relate to, whether they relate to the domestic market, they relate to the regional market, or they relate to the international market. Let's go into government operations. We have an hour and 15 minutes, so we have to speed up a little bit. I'm hoping some of you have even limited exposure to economics. How many of you? Everybody, right? Okay, that's good. Again, we are not just looking, this course is not intended to teach you economics. It is teaching you to interpret economic information so that you can make an assessment as to the quality of the bonds that you're interested in investing in, of the government bonds that you're interested in investing. An important part of government operation is the formulation and execution of fiscal policy. What is fiscal policy? Fiscal policy has to do with how much revenue the government, its taxes, and its expenditure, and the deficit, because if you have more expenditure than revenue, you have a deficit. But the levels of expenditure, revenue, and deficit have significant macroeconomic impact. For example, in the US now, they are planning to do a major capital expenditure project to revise the infrastructure. That will have macroeconomic implications because that in itself will generate employment, will generate growth. So that the fiscal policy can have significant influence on economic growth. It can have significant inflation influence on your rates of inflation. It could have significant influence on your balance of payments because if, for example, the government is spending a lot of money and buying things from overseas, then it means that your balance of payments will be affected. And we'll discuss balance of payments shortly. And it could have significant effect on your debt level. If you run huge deficits for a long period of time, just like a human being, if you spend more money than you make, for a long period of time. You could only do that by borrowing. And if you keep doing that every year, then you'll become overwhelmed by debt after some period of time. And governments sometimes become overwhelmed by debt. A very important document to understand the fiscal policies of the government is the budget. And not just the nice speech that the government gives, but the actual numbers. You need to see what is the total revenue, how is it broken down, what is the total, how the taxes, what sort of taxes are implemented in the budget, what is the expenditure, what is current expenditure, what is the capital expenditure, what sort of infrastructural development is it, what is the deficit, and how would that affect debt. All of those are important issues in helping you assess whether or not the government is doing well and whether or not you should continue to invest in the security of that government. The national budget outlines the government policies for a fiscal year. Policies translated into transactions which are classified in broad categories under expenditure and revenues. Those are the two things that you would see in a budget. And you have a breakdown here of the type of, they talk about current and capital expenditure. Your current expenditure would be mainly expenditure in relation to salaries and wages, goods and service, interest payments, transfer and subsidies. It's just like you in your ordinary, if you have to buy food and so on, that is your current expenditure. If you have to buy clothes, that's your current expenditure. But if you buy a car, that's a capital expenditure because a car will last you beyond the current year and would probably last you for 5 years. Or a house, you make an investment. Those are your capital expenditure. And it's the same thing for government. If you build a road or build a school, that's going to last for 20, 30 years, then that is capital expenditure. But if they pay for goods and services, for materials for the hospital, for books and so on, for the schools, if they pay interest on their debt, all of those are annual expenses and they will be part of the current expenditure. Transactions increase. Current revenues, there's a definition here of net worth, transactions that increase the net worth of the government. But the notion of net worth for government is something that that need a lot of clarification. But the current revenue are categorized into non-tax and tax sources. So that taxes would be like your income tax. Your non-tax would be like your passport fees and things of that nature. So taxes are tax imposed by legislation. The fees usually relate mainly to services that the government provides. Taxes refer to compulsory transfers to the government, and that is the point. Taxes don't mean that you got any service for it directly. You might get it down the road in terms of government has to build schools and so on, but the other fees has to do with paying for a service that the government has given you. Tax revenue forms the dominant share of total revenue, about 85%. Don't take these figures. Every country is different. And from year to year, it changes. But certainly in the OECS, the figures range about 85% of revenue is tax revenue, and 15% is non-tax revenue. And it averages about 22% of the gross domestic product of the country. And this is a list of the main categories of tax: taxes on income, taxes on property, taxes on goods and services, taxes on international trade. Now, non-tax revenue is fees and charges, fines, and other miscellaneous type of revenue. Capital expense transaction is fixed assets in the public sector investment program, net lending. For example, if you lend, if you're in St. Kitts, if you are the federal government in St. Kitts and you lend $100,000 to Nevis, that will go into net lending. Or if you lend to private sector enterprises, that will go into lending. And grants, like if you get grants from other foreign governments, those are capital receipts. But you also have, if you give a grant to a Dominica because they had a hurricane, that would be a capital expenditure. The portion of total expenditure and net lending that exceed total receipts from revenue and grants represent the fiscal balance. When you take all your expenditure together and you subtract them from your revenues, you get a deficit. That deficit has to be funded, and that if it is a big deficit and it can chronic run from year to year, it's going to increase your debt, because the only way you can finance that deficit is by borrowing. So that if you are evaluating government securities and you are evaluating the capacity of the government to pay, then it's going to be very critical that you get a handle as to the deficit and how is it behaving over time. Are they running up high deficit? Is it increasing? Is it decreasing? That is a very important idea for you to decide whether the government is performing and whether or not it is likely to be able to meet its obligation. A positive fiscal balance would mean that the government is able to either reduce its debt, because you may have debts before, so that if you have more revenues, you could use it to reduce your debt, or alternatively, you could have cash balances in the bank and investments in the bank. How is the deficit funded? And the way the deficit is funded have very, very significant macroeconomic implications. Firstly, and I'll list them and I'll go to them later, they can run down its foreign reserves, borrow from the central bank, borrowing from the commercial banking sector, borrowing from non-bank domestic sector, and borrowing externally. The macroeconomic impact of a government deficit depends on the way the deficit is financed. If you run down your reserves, you can create an exchange rate crisis. Now, you don't hear much about that, because in truth and in fact, in our system, the government can't run down the reserves. The reserves are managed by the central bank, and there's a law, the ECCB Act, which restricts access to those reserves so that the government don't have easy access to those reserves. And that is why our currency has remained so strong for such a long time. And that is why we have been able to keep inflation under control, because that looseness in some other systems, we just don't have the flexibility to be loose in relation to monetary policy or in relation to how we manage our reserves. Central bank borrowing you could borrow from the central bank. But every time you borrow from the central bank, it means that the central bank is creating money. And if you have, if the central bank create money, it can result in inflation. Again, in the context of the Eastern Caribbean, we, our central bank, the government do not have easy access to the central bank. The government cannot just go and take a loan from the central bank. That loan has to be within certain limits, and it has to be as prescribed by the ECCB legislation. And the ECCB itself, the management of the ECCB, has to be satisfied as to the justification of the loan. So I say here, the first two options are limited by the Eastern Caribbean Currency Union arrangement. But they can borrow from commercial banks. And when they borrow from commercial banks, it has two effects. One of them is that it crowds out the private sector, so that if the government is continually borrowing from the private sector to fund government projects, it means the bank would not have enough resources to fund private projects. And that in itself would have implications for economic growth. It would have implications for balance of payments, because the private sector would need that money to be able to produce goods, to sell overseas, etc. And if they're not able to get funding, new enterprises want to be established and they can't get funding because our government is running a huge deficit and relying on the central bank. The other thing is that it also means interest rates will go up, because if the bank have limited funds because our government is borrowing, then if you want to get that funds from them, you'll have to pay the price of the funds, which is the interest rate, and the price of the funds will increase if the supply of funds is limited. So you begin to see that if you run down reserves, you're going to affect your exchange rate, and you that nice 270 that you have maintained for such a long time will suddenly drop, and your currency devalues. If you borrow from the central bank, it creates inflation. If you borrow from commercial banks, it crowds out the private sector, and it results in hikes in the interest rates. You could borrow externally too, from foreign governments or from foreign private sector entities or from international bodies. But that's a high risk, because if you borrow excessively overseas, at some stage, first you have to pay it back. And so that when you have to pay the interest every year, you have to use whatever foreign reserve you have to be able to pay that interest every year. And that in itself creates a very risky situation in relation to debt. You have to be able to generate a lot of foreign revenues, a lot of export earnings to be able to pay that debt. And sometimes that creates a significant challenge for governments and creates defaults. This is a little plug here for the RGSM. A lot of governments offer securities on the RGSM. And through the RGSM, they are able to offer the security, not just in CINCIS and NEBIS, but throughout the entire currency union. They are also better able to get better rates because it is a competitive market. You have more players buying the securities, so the government could generally get better rates. And it is an organized market. And the fact that the central bank or the stock exchange is behind it, it adds credibility to the market. If you don't have good fiscal policy, then the government lose credibility. If the government is able to act prudently, it builds their credibility. It helps in the development of a longer-term market, because if the government is irresponsible, then people start to not trust the market, and it stunts the development of the market. If they act prudent, they would curtail growth in debt, they will reduce borrowing costs, because when government have a significant amount of debt, then it affects their borrowing costs, and they would reduce future levels of taxation. That's what happens. They have huge debt and they have to pay off the debt. They're having problems with paying debt. Then they find themselves having to introduce new taxes or higher rates of taxes, which itself could inhibit economic growth in the country. monetary policy. Now, I spoke about fiscal policy, and the fiscal policy has to do with how the government manages its budget, you know, to achieve economic objectives in relation to growth, in relation to inflation, in relation to employment, in relation to the balance of payments, and in relation to a whole number of macroeconomic objectives. But there's another tool which government can use to influence these macroeconomic variables. That is monetary policy. And I say government advises me because in the context of the Eastern Caribbean, the entity charged with monetary policy is the central bank. The government do not have any rights in relation to monetary policy. Now, what is monetary policy? It seeks to achieve various macroeconomic objectives by influencing the amount of money and credit in the economy. So that some of the macroeconomic objectives, the most important objectives it will have, it'll be to maintain a good inflation rate, make sure that the inflation rate is not too high, ensure that people's expectations, inflation expectations are not too high, and it also have an impact on maintaining the stability of the EC dollars. If you start to create a whole lot of money within our economy, if the central bank begins to create, make available a lot of money in our economy, people begin to buy. Once people begin to buy goods, they're going to buy a lot of imported goods, which are going to require foreign reserves, and that will run down our foreign reserves. And that in itself would result in a devaluation of the currency. So it has to be act very responsibly in order to be able to protect the currency and protect the peg that has added a tremendous amount of certainty to our economy over the years. From the 1960s, actually, that peg has been in place from the late 1960s to now, which in an era of devaluations and flotations, etc., is a tremendous achievement on our part. Non-credible monetary policy raises investor perception of inflation and devaluation rate. If investors believe that if they don't trust the central bank, if they don't trust the monetary policy, and they believe that there's going to be inflation, then what will happen, or they believe that there could be a devaluation, then what they do? They themselves create the devaluation. Why? Because they take their money outside. And once they begin to take the money outside and convert it into US dollars, it means they're running down our reserves and you will have a devaluation. That is why the perception of devaluation is sometimes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because people believe that they're going to be a devaluation. People begin to take your money out of the country and that creates the devaluation. The tools of monetary policy, you have open market operation. What this is, if, for example, the economy is tending to be recessionary, like it seems as though it is not, it is going into a recession, the central bank would buy more securities. And by buying securities, what it does, it is making more money available in the economy. Because the usual case is usually by government securities, and some of these securities will be held by the commercial bank. The commercial bank holds the government securities, the central bank buy these securities. They have to pay money for it, and when they have to pay money for it, that stimulates the amount of money that is in the economy and helps to stimulate growth in the economy. They also, the reverse is true. If they feel that there's a trend towards inflation, they could decide to sell government securities. And by selling the securities, what they do is they begin to suck some of the money out of the economy, and they will exert some downward pressure on the rate of inflation. They could also manipulate the reserve requirement ratio. Every bank must comply with a reserve requirement, so that the central bank could stipulate, say, for example, that you must keep 10% of the amount that you lend out to people in reserve. You must keep it in reserve at the central bank. We must hold it for you, or you must keep it in a certain form. so that in itself limits how much money a bank could lend. So if a bank have $10 in reserve, a bank could only lend $100. If he have $200 in reserve, he could only lend $2,000, could only lend 10 times what it has. But if the central bank wants to increase the bank lending activities, it can say that reserve is only 5%. So if the reserve is only 5%, they only need to hold 5% of what they lend out. What it means, if they have $100, now they could lend $2,000 on that $100. They can lend 20 times what they have in reserve. So by specifying the reserve requirement, the central bank can decide whether to stimulate economic activity by making more money in the economy, or by dampening economic activity, or dampening inflation by constraining the ability of the banks, the commercial banks, to lend money. Then there's inflation targeting. We don't do that here, but this is very common now in most of the US, in the UK, in Europe. In fact, in the US and UK, what the central bank is target a particular inflation rate. And just by targeting that inflation rate, it means that it gives expectations. People have a better expectation of what the central bank would do. For example, in both the UK and the US, the targeted inflation rate is 2% core inflation. And later on, we could discuss what is core inflation. So it means that people expect, if inflation rate goes more than 2%, people will expect that the central bank will intervene to kind of bring down the inflation rate to back to 2%. Or if it is less, they expect that the central bank will be involved in expansionary activities, we're expanding the money supply in order to increase the rate. And then there's moral suasion, the speeches and so on that the central bank makes. The governor makes and so on will encourage bankers to lend more or to lend less, depending on what the central bank is trying to achieve. There are structural policies that you also have, especially if you have long-term bonds, you have to focus on structural policies and see what the government is doing, because there are some structural issues that can affect how the economy perform in the long run. For example, the labor market rigidity. One of the big difference between the US and Europe is that Europe have a lot of labor market rigidity, which constrain growth. In our context, we have a minimum wage, and that has to be managed very, very carefully, because if the minimum wage is too high, it means that a number of persons, for example, instead of getting a maid, they do it themselves. It means a lot of even big enterprises find that their payroll is too high, that they have to lay off people. It means that some enterprise, because they must have the people and they can't afford it, some enterprise go under. So that a minimum wage should not be a means of controlling the labor market. It should be set as a figure. You decide, for example, that in this economy, I want nobody to live below this standard of living. And so it's set with that in mind, not to somewhere calculate and determine what the proper rate should be. The proper rate should be determined by market forces, because if you make it too high, it sometimes will constrain growth. Collective bargaining processes. In some countries, for example, in Antigua, they have a quota, industrial relations quota, which investors perceive sided a lot with workers. And that in itself affects foreign investors. They become very scared about investing in Antigua. They become very scared about employing people. And in a lot of other countries, we have a labor ministry, a department of labor. And sometimes it is supposed to play an arbitration role between labor and the employer, but sometimes it doesn't. And once there's a perception that the labor is not playing that role fairly, then it affects people's willingness to employ and to create growth by that employment. Payroll imposition. If you look at things, for example, You don't have income tax, but you have a surcharge, you have social services levy, they used to call it. But the employer pay a portion and the employee pay a portion. Then you have employment injury. Employer pay a portion, employee pay a portion. Then you have severance payment. The employer pay a portion, the employee pay a portion. By the end of the day, an employer has to pay 11-12%. Then they have social security, employer pay a portion, the employee pay a portion. So that the cost of employing people could be a significant constraint to economic growth in a country. I'm not saying they are too high or too low. I'm just saying that if you are evaluating your securities, you have to look to see how these are moving and whether or not, if they are going up, whether or not they are likely to affect growth and productivity over the long term. Then there's deregulation. Again, some countries have index.
Excuse me, I can't hear you properly.
Yeah, me neither. You're breaking up.
I think he's gone.
Oh, he probably just muted.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to try to get Mr. Lawrence back on, so can you hold on just a few minutes, please? Thanks. Okay, folks, Mr. Lawrence is having some internet issues, so he's going to, he asked that we give him just a few more minutes to try to reconnect with you. So thank you for your patience in the meantime.
Hi, good morning, Mr. Pinard.
Hi, good morning.
Welcome.
Thank you.
All right. Just a pointer for our participants. Mr. Lawrence's presentation would continue tomorrow afternoon at 3, between 3 and 4. And we are going to begin, well, we should be on break now. So we would resume at 10:30. And that session would be covered by Mr. Darren Pinard under the theme or the topic financial analysis. So Mr. Pinard, our participants are currently on break, so we would commence at 10:30.
Okay.
Okay.
And we run till 12:15, right? Generally.
Yes, we go till 12:15. Lunch break, well, yes, 12:15. And then we would go into lunch.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, I will come back in. No, and that's it. It's almost time.
Yeah, it's almost 10:30.
Everybody, you seen me now?
Yes, hello.
Can we continue or is it too late?
Mr. Lawrence?
Yeah.
We are, the participants are currently on break.
Okay.
So, but we already have the other facilitator lined up to connect.
Okay, no problem. So let's set another time then.
So then we can resume your session tomorrow at 3?
At 3? I'm finished tomorrow. What do I have? What time am I finished tomorrow?
Sorry, Avenue, let me jump in here. Mr. Lawrence, you have the case study on portfolio management and asset allocation from 2 o'clock tomorrow.
Till 3 o'clock?
2 to 3, and then 3 to 4, they are exercises and review. So you have an hour in here that you can play with.
So I can do it 2 to 3 then?
Well, yes, you can do that from 2 to 3 because you have the whole afternoon tomorrow from 2 to 4. From 2 to 4:30.
From 2 to 4. Okay, no problem. So let's do it at 2, and then we'll continue with the portfolio at that time.
Okay, all right.
Okay, good.
Okay,
so
then.
Tomorrow, we'll continue this, and then we move right into portfolio. But the rest of the portfolio will start, will go as usual.
Okay, all right.
Like 9 o'clock tomorrow and 11 o'clock tomorrow, and then 2 o'clock.
Yeah, 9:45 tomorrow.
Nine o'clock.
9:45.
Oh, I thought it was 9 to 9:45.
We have the continuation of basics of equity and bond markets from 9 to 9:45 tomorrow morning.
So give me my times tomorrow.
Okay, 9:45. From 9:45 to 12:15. There's a break in between.
Okay.
And then you come back in the afternoon from 2 to 4:30.
2 to 4:30. Okay, no problem. Okay.
In the meantime, could you send us this slide for this presentation? So we can...
For this presentation, I'll send it to you.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, no problem. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm sorry for the hiccup, but I'll try to do better tomorrow.
Okay, we understand. Thank you. Okay, folks, we apologize for that technology glitch. You know that these things are not within our control. So we're hoping that tomorrow afternoon Mr. Lawrence can finish or conclude his presentation. And in the meantime, we will forward his presentation to you so you'd have those slides to go through in preparation for tomorrow's session, the continuation. And once again, we do apologize for that the breaking transmission. Avanis, over to you.
All right, thank you, Ms. Faisal. Participants, are you there? You should be back.
Here. I'm here.
Okay. All right. Here with us, we have Mr. Darren Pinard, and today he would be presenting on the topic financial analysis. Mr. Pinard, I turn over to you.
Thank you. Okay, good morning, everybody. Just want to make sure everybody can hear me. Hello?
Yes, sir.
Hi, good morning.
Okay, hi. My name is Darren Pinard, as you were just informed. I am an employee of the National Bank of Dominica. I'm the manager of underwriting, monitoring, and review at the bank. Graduated from University of the West Indies, Banking and Finance in 2010. Currently, I am wrapping up a CPA program that I'm doing, the CPA in accounting and so on. I have done some levels of the CPA, the CFA, sorry, Chartered Financial Analysis program and so on. Financial analysis is something that is very much at the center of what we do in underwriting, primarily to assess all credit requests and so on that coming into the bank to analyze whether or not the credit worthiness meets our acceptable standard and so on. And so the center to all that is structural financial analysis and so on, specifically for the commercial requests that we are coming in. So this subject is something that I am very intimate with, and hence my decision to do that class with the CSA. I just want everybody to let me know if you can see the slide that I have selected to share, because I am new to this mode of lecturing. I'm not a teacher, I don't do it often. And so just want to make sure that everything is working okay as it should be.
Yes, we can see.
Okay, good. Okay. We're looking at the objective, or what is the objective of the financial statement, the purpose of the financial statement? And that is to provide useful information to stakeholders. All stakeholders, people refer to people that would have any sort of interest, material interest in the company. That would include the first and foremost, the shareholders of the company, the lenders to the company, that is the banks and the bond and other debt holders. That would include the government for tax and regulatory reasons and so on. That would include the management to assess, analyze their performance and make plans for the future. That would include employees. Employees need to assess their bargaining options for pay increases and so on, things like that, and look at the security of their own employment in the short and long term. So everybody that would have interest in the enterprise or the part of the people, and the financial statement is meant to provide useful information for their purview and decision making. Now, we have three primary types of financial statements that we are interested in terms of this being the compiler, the reviewed, and the audited financial statement. Now, the lowest grade of statements is the compiled statement. In the compiled statement, the auditor really is not able to give an opinion on the accuracy and the authenticity of the information that is being presented. Okay, but he will ensure that he will get a good understanding of the accounting principles, financial systems, and so on in use, and to present the information in good form and so on. It is up to this information will not be very reliable to the more high-end stakeholders and so on, especially if you're looking at companies that would be trading on the securities exchange and that type of thing. You would need to have more quality statements, and that it could be useful for basic lending decisions, a minimal amount and so on, that doesn't pose a significant risk. Generally, these would be for smaller businesses where they're looking to manage and minimize expenses and costs, both with respect to having an accountant on staff or outsourcing one when needed, and maintaining the whole accounting system and so on. So generally, you could just have some compiled statements done where the expenses would be managed. Generally, in preparing accounting statements, you have to get the correct balance between the cost and the usefulness the use of that statement. It doesn't make sense to incur exorbitant costs for the statement when there is really no need for you to present such statement. You might have a small family-owned business, you're really not subject to any like lenders or equity holders or stock markets and so on, people type of uses. So there's no need for overdoing it. The second level we have is the reviewed statement. These are a bit more quality than the compiled statement. The auditor will do more checks. They will look at, do some verifying of the information that is being presented on the statement for the to generally be able to assess the accuracy and that type of thing. However, the assessment is still not completely thorough, and he would not present a formal opinion on the statements accordingly. That is reserved for the audited financial statement. The audited statement at the highest level of statement that can be provided. Now, this is what would be needed for the larger firms where you would have significant debt obligations and equity trading on the securities market and this type of thing. It will also give the government and other stakeholders more assurance in the information that they're reviewing, the accuracy of it, and so on. Lower quality statements will probably more likely prompt an audit, for example, and stuff like that from the government and the tax authorities. But the audit statements will give reasonable assurance that the information that they're testing is error-free, and so on. If there are material misstatements or errors, then they would be specifically identified and so on, where the auditor would indicate where he would have found such errors or a misstatement and so on. So this is the highest quality of statements that is available at this time. These are generally required to be prepared by a chartered accountant, CPA, CTCA, and such. Someone that doesn't hold such a professional designation would not be authorized to present such a financial statement. The financial statements have a number of parts. Generally, it's like about four primary parts, but we just put an overview of the various parts of the audited report. We would have management report and discussion. This would be primarily for the larger enterprises. Statements of financial position, also known as balance sheet. Statement of changes in equity. Statement of comprehensive income, which is the income statement, and the statement of other comprehensive income. The statement of cash flows, and then we have the notes to the financial statement. We will do an overview, a brief on some of them, and we'll go into slightly more details on the main one, and so on in the upcoming slides. Management discussion. Oh, by the way, I just want everybody to feel free to stop me at any time if you need to discuss anything further, like if you want to dive into something a bit more deeply, because I might be moving along with the understanding that you probably got what I'm saying, and but feel free to stop me and ask questions at any time if you need to. Management discussion. This is often presented by both the chairman and the general manager or managing director, depending on the type of company. The report presents an overview of the firm's performance, the environment over the past period, the period from which the financial statement is representing. Generally, you will get information in the discussion that would not be readily identifiable in the statement. By analyzing the statement, you will probably be able to look and see the movement of cash and assets and so on, but it may not always be easily identifiable as to what is really happening beyond that, what is causing, what is driving those various changes and so on. So the management discussion is very good reading. Anybody looking to do an in-depth analysis should read the report, and you would generally get information that you would not otherwise be able to receive from the analysis of the statement and so on. So a lot of people, when we go into the financial, we're looking at the financial report, we kind of skim through the management discussion. But it all depends on what exactly you're looking at the report. For the greater the decision you have to make, especially for example looking at a lending decision or investing decision, then the more important the management discussion takes on. The statement of cash flows, the statement of cash flows, also called the cash flow statement, is it shows the changes in the balance sheet and the income statement and so on, and the cash equivalents in the business. It is broken down into three parts: the operating, the investment, and the financing section activities. Specifically, it is concerned about cash flows in and out of the business. Now we all know what is we should all know what is accrual accounting. Accrual accounting is not based on cash and the cash flows. You would record a sale, for example, of merchandise, even if you have not received cash for it, you could have sold those goods on credit. Now selling an item on credit is in itself not going to enable you to pay your loan, for example, or you're not going to use that to pay dividends, because loans are serviced with cash. You must have money on your account or money on hand to service a debt. So having completed a sale in itself is not going to enable you to pay a debt. What is going to enable you to pay off a debt is actually receiving cash and having that cash available to service that obligation. So what the cash flow statement looks to do is to actually look at the cash that comes with the operating activity and the overall activities of the business. So the operating section of the cash flow, it is very closely linked with the income statement on the financial statement. Now, generally what you will find is the relationship between the operating cash flow balance and the income statement and operating income will give you an indication as to the quality of the firm's actual performance. Now, the higher the cash flow is compared to the operating activity cash flow and balance is compared to the operating income on the statement of comprehensive income, is the higher the quality of the firm's operations. That means, for example, that they're actually collecting on their sales. So when they sell an item, they receive cash in return and so on. So there is a much closer relationship, much nearer figure between the cash flow, the operating cash flow balance from the cash flow statement and the operating income from the income statement. The investing part of the cash flow, it speaks to where the firm spends and its money more or less in terms of fixed assets like plant, property, equipment, vehicles, various things of the such investing activities. And then the financing part of the cash flow speaks of cash received and paid to and from the equity and debt holder. So, for example, if you receive a loan from a bank, you would be able to see that in the financing part of the cash flow. If you paid off a loan or you sold shares or you paid dividends, those types of activities would be the financing section of the cash flow. The notes to the financial statement. The notes are necessary because not all relevant information is communicated through the standard statements, that is the balance sheet, income statement, equity statement, and statement of cash flow. You do not get all the details in those primary statements. So now you will get a lot more details in the notes to the statement. The notes will show you how the accountant arrived at the figures that are presented in the balance sheet and income statement and so on. It will also explain any irregularities or change in accounting principles and various things that the business would have undertaken over the period, or that would have gone into preparing the financial statement and so on. So the notes are instrumental. Generally, it's very difficult, if not near impossible, to do a proper analysis of the statements without frequently comparing the numbers in the primary statements with the notes. You're looking at one depreciation figure on the balance sheet. It doesn't tell you much in and of itself. So you will just know you're looking at depreciation and amortization one figure. But now if you're looking at the depreciation schedule, you'll be able to see the full information, for example, like what fixed assets were purchased, were sold, the depreciation on each, where it started, where it ended, and everything like that. So the notes are very important to the analysis. Financial statements. The statement of financial position, generally also known as the balance sheet, it presents the financial position of the entity at a specific time, at a given date. It doesn't cover a period. It's not a balance sheet as of January to December 31st. It is just a balance sheet as of December 31st. So what it shows is the financial structure and so on of the business. The elements of the balance sheet comprises the assets, liabilities, and equity. The assets are everything that the business owns, either fixed or current, either long or short term. Liabilities, everything that the business owes, whether or not it owes it over the next 12 months, the next week, or in 20 years' time, everything will be presented on the liability side, and the equity primarily refers to the difference between those two. The equity, the component of the equity, we will go into each of those in the next, in the upcoming slides. The assets are broken up into current and non-current assets. The current assets represent the value of all assets that can be converted to cash and are used to fund the ongoing operations of the company and pay off current expenses. Current assets are important to businesses because they can be used to fund the day-to-day business operations and to pay for the ongoing expenses. Now, we have some examples there that include cash, receivables, prepaid expenses, and so on. So what the current assets are really is the lifeblood of the business. I spoke earlier about being able to, for example, pay your loan, pay your interest on your bonds and stuff like that, pay dividends at the end of a period when declared and all those things. Now, the current assets are what you're going to need to be able to service those obligations. If you have a business that has a lot of assets, like a lot of land, and you know we have some customers, they have a very high net worth, for example, a lot of land, a lot of properties and so on, but they're not very liquid. Now what you will find is a lot of times that these customers would end up in financial distress because they still cannot afford to service their debt, their obligations, their loans are late, their dividends are not being declared and paid, and so on and so on. Even if they have a strong net worth, because they are not sufficiently liquid, the creditors come calling and they are unable to service those obligations. So the current assets, one of the most important is the lifeblood of the business. It enables the business to continue operating on a day-to-day basis. The non-current assets, these are the long-term investments or the assets that have a useful life of more than 1 year. It is more difficult to convert the non-current assets into cash easily without a significant loss of value. For example, if you have a building, you cannot easily convert that into cash to service your loan. And if you choose to do so because you are no other means, then you'd like, if you needed to do that in the next month or two, you might likely have to sell that building at a significant discount. So you would lose a lot of value and it's not very liquid and so on. And just to highlight the difference, a current asset, the liquidity in a current asset, the liquidity would mean that you can easily be converted to cash, if it's already cash, without any loss in value in a very short period of time. Fixed assets, that is not possible. Now, these would include land, property, plant, equipment, long-term investment, vehicles, and all the other stuff that the businesses use this, but not for debt service in ongoing operation. The liabilities. We also have current and non-current liabilities. Current liabilities are the company's debt obligations that are due within a year or within one normal operating cycle. Now, current liabilities are usually settled through the exploitation of the current assets. Now, just to point out, the normal operating cycle for some businesses could extend beyond the year. Say, for example, if you have a shipping company and a boat building company, it could take a lot more than 1 year to build a single boat. And the construction of that asset would be one operating cycle. So it would still be like a current liability would still fall within the purview of that period. It may be extended beyond the 1 year. So if you have obligations against that thing, it would still be current. Examples of short-term debt, that is like government securities and so on. accounts payable, if you bring and purchase stock, inventory, and so on, usually you have some short-term payable period, some short-term credit available, like probably 1 month or up to 90 days and so on, accounts payable, accrued liabilities. Other accrued liabilities also be part of the non-current liabilities, current liabilities. Non-current liabilities. Generally, non-current, before we move on, non-current liabilities would also be presented on a proper financial statement, would be broken up into its non-current and its current and past. So if you have a 20-year loan, for example, on the financial statements, you would present the amount of that loan that is due over the next 12 months in the current liability section, and the part that is due beyond the 1 year in the non-current section, even if it is the same loan. So the non-current part refers to those obligations that are due beyond 1 year. Even if some of it is due within a year, the non-current part would still be presented in the long-term liability section of it. And this would be like long-term loans, bonds, payable, and so on, pension obligations, etc. The equity is the excess value of the asset over the liability. It is what will be left over if the company liquidated all its assets, fixed and current, and paid off all its liabilities, current and non-current as well. The components of equity would be like the shares, the common shares and preference shares, retained earnings, statutory reserves, accumulated other comprehensive income, AOC, etc. With respect to equity, while it's not on this slide, we will look at some of it in the ratio analysis, but just to let you know, the more equity you have, the better, obviously. Stronger your equity, the much better you are. The retained earnings part in the statement of equity is particularly important, because what retained earnings in itself informs you of is the cumulative amount of profit, net profit that the business have held on to since it started operations. Now, retained earnings would be net assets earned less the dividend paid. So that will be the total sum of all net income earned minus all dividends that have been paid. That will be summed up into one figure called the retained earnings of the business. So usually it is one of the first things I look for when I look at the equity statement, because it tells me how the business has done over its history. If you have a strong positive retained earnings that you know, even if the business would have had some intermittent fluctuations in performance, maybe could have incurred 1 or 2 periods of losses, even maybe the current period you're analyzing is itself a loss period. But generally, the retained earnings, you say on average, overall, in the grand scheme of things, business is a successful business or not. Negative retained earnings is to me very troubling. It means on average, especially for a business that is very established. An average business is not a successful business. It's been financed otherwise. Its own performance is not what's keeping it going. And even if equity is positive, equity could be positive because the owners of the business have injected and are continuing to inject more capital into the business. But for the business to continue to operate on its own merit, to pay its own way, then the retained earnings have to be positive in the long run. The statement of comprehensive income comprises two parts, the income statement and the other comprehensive comprehensive income part of it, the other comprehensive income. So the comprehensive deterioration in the company's net assets from non-owner sources during a specific time period and includes both the income statement and the other comprehensive income. The income statement part of it is the part of it that is more well known to people. The other comprehensive part of it is generally, you'll more find it more complex enterprises. But those that have a lot of maybe investment securities and so on, where you would have to be tracking unrealized gains and losses and so on. The income statement provides an overview of the revenues and expenses, including taxes and so on, realized over a specific period. The income statement, unlike the balance sheet, is not at a specific time. It covers a period, like generally 1 year, or like we had said previously, one operating cycle. But it's generally 1 year it's covered on the income statement. So the revenues you're looking at is from the beginning date, January 1st to December 31st. That'll be all the revenues the business have earned and so on and so forth. All the expenses presented as expenses incurred over that time period. The statement of comprehensive income. The elements of the income statement include the revenues, expenses, and the profit and the loss. Revenues, the total sales or income generated during the year. It will include sales for which payment have and have not yet generated. So whether or not you sell in cash, whether or not you sell on credit, they would all be captured in the revenues or the sales figure presented on the income statement. As well for the expenses, these include the cost of goods sold, direct expenses for if you have a services and so on, operating expenses, taxes, etc. These would all be captured in the income statement. The operating expenses are those that are not directly related to the goods or services. These will be for like more like the overheads, like management salaries and so on. According to the type of business you presented, some of these salaries would be broken up into direct and indirect expenses. For example, you might have some salaries, maybe like for the people actually working in a factory, being included in cost of goods sold. You would have electricity and so on related to the operation of the factory machinery and so on. All these could be included in cost of goods sold. These would be direct expenses. So what you'll find is if the factory operation had to stop, these expenses would not be incurred. So generally these expenses would form part of cost of goods sold. The operating expenses would be expenses that are incurred despite or irrespective of whether or not the factory had to shut down temporarily or not. We're talking about like on a short term basis. So you would still have to pay, for example, rent even if you stop operating. Since you continue to own the lease for property, you still have to pay the rent. That would be an operating expense, a non-direct expense. You still have to pay management salaries. Even if the managers that are not in the factory store, they still have to be paid. These are not directly related to the actual items being produced. The profit or the loss is the result or the residual of the revenue minus the expenses. So that is kind of very straightforward. Now we're going to start to go into the analysis part of the statement, the financial statement analysis segment. Now, first we will look at the vertical common size assessment of a statement. This is applicable for internal performance review as well as for comparison to peers and benchmarking. In vertical analysis, all the items in a particular statement are represented as a percentage of a particular item, and that item being sales on the income statement or total assets on the balance sheet. We will look at some examples in some future slides coming up. But just to like, so vertical analysis, you have the sales on the income statement, and everything else is analyzed in comparison to sales, as it compares to sales on the balance sheet. Everything is looked at in relation to the total assets of the business. The horizontal analysis is identifies trends in ratios over time. And to me, I think minimal three years if possible is a reasonable time to do a review over. You could do it over five, but a lot can happen in 5 years. The business is the size and structure of the business could change rather significantly over 5 years. So the analysis might be of 5 years ago, the statement of 5 years ago might not really be representative of the current operations. So 3 years is a better horizon, in my opinion. You don't want to go too far back. But at the same time, you don't want to just look at 2 years, because certain things take a little bit of time to develop, and you might need to look at it for a little bit longer to see and probably assess where we're going with that and so on. So we're looking at 3 years is to me a reasonable time period. So it's a useful tool for forecasting purposes, and we will identify trends and so on, highlight like growing, stable or declining profitability or expenses and so on. We will look at liquidity, leverages and so on. You can see where they have been, where they were a few years ago, where they are right now and so on. And we can probably use that to forecast where we think they will go based on what's been happening and so on. The overall ratio analysis, it shows the relationship of certain elements in relation to other elements on the primary statement. It is used to assess the financial health of a company and also identify trends over time, as you say, in periods of time. It's also very useful, again, for the forecasting purposes. So I say we're going to look at an example. We'll look at the income statement for Village Shipping Inc. Everything is presented on the financial statement. In the middle here, between the 2014 and 2015, we have sales representing 100%. When you're looking at the digital analysis, the percentage next to sales will always be 100%, because everything is compared to that number. In this case here, you have cost of sales representing 53.8% of it. The gross profit being 46%. Now, in looking at that right now, I think I would have better if I presented one that's showing more than 1 year of the vertical analysis. But we should be able to see some more examples on the looking at the balance sheet section. But looking at this one, we can see that like wages, for example, would be 163 over 500, 32% in 2014. And then we have 154 divided by 475. Again, 32%. So wages have remained relatively stable. Even if, for example, you see that the amount of pay in wages increased, it increased by $9,000 from 154 to 163. But as a percentage of sales, wages have remained very constant. That could happen, for example, if you pay in a lot of your wages on commission. So the more sales you generate, for example, is the more salaries you pay out. If you work in like for an insurance company where they get a commission based on the amount of sales, that could easily happen. Let's look at a figure that might have shifted. Office expenses look to have been cut down in half over the period. which was like 0.2%. But the amount is so small, really, it doesn't take much to see the office expenses. And so I wasn't paying much attention to office expenses. But overall, that company looks to have been very stable over the 2 years I'm reporting. There isn't much to look at in terms of the vertical analysis or the horizontal analysis. Now, if you're looking at that, now it on its of itself, it tells you a story, but it doesn't tell you a lot. What you would really need to do is you'd have to look at either some industry averages, industry standards, so really shipping, you know, like a shipping company. So you would need to know on average how much the shipping company spend on cost of goods compared to sales. Now, if the amount is generally much lower than the 54% that we see in the Village Shipping Inc. doing there, then we would have to figure out, okay, 53.8% on this is not really a good figure because it is significantly above what the average firm spends compared to its sales, and so on. So this is how you really look at vertical analysis. First, you look at it from 1 year to the other, but even more importantly, you look at it in relation to the peers, you know, look at to the industry that it's operating in. And the balance sheet will give you a better picture in terms of from 1 year to the other. So you can look to see, has anything changed significantly compared to total assets over the analytical period and over the assessment period. In just looking at this statement here, I can see, for example, that long-term liabilities doubled over the period compared to assets. While at the same time, we have an increase in stockholders' equity. So we have the total assets increasing, doubling, and then you have an increase in the shareholders' equity doubling. Looking at total liabilities, long-term liabilities decreasing. So what we can just say, if we're looking at just, for example, just looking at just those three figures, we would say that the business sort of replacing debt with equity. That is the analysis, that is the conclusion I would come to in looking at that statement. So the business could have, for example, paid off some of its debt from ongoing, like, cash generated in operations, reducing the relationship, the ratio of debt to equity in the balance sheet, and so on. That generally looks to me like the business is doing some restructuring of its overall financial structure. It is increasing the level of debt compared to equity in the whole financing of the operation. Now, without more scope, probably with respect to the management discussions and some of the notes and so on, we would not be easily able to identify why that might have been done and so on. It could have just been a debt matured and had to be paid off, which is in the normal operating and processes, or it could be a strategic decision, management decision to do that. It could have, for example, find that the business is just too heavily leveraged and it wants to reduce the level of debt. But that would not be likely because the 46% overall leverage liabilities to assets is not high. It is actually a very strong balance sheet if you have to look at it. The horizontal analysis. Now, the ratios are not presented with respect to one item on the statement, but presented against themselves over time. So you're looking at an increase or decrease in the particular line item from one period to the other. So if we're looking at, we're starting out with sales, we have $1.5 million in 2008 and $1.2 million. So that is almost $300,000 increase. and that represents a 24-25% increase in sales in 1 year. That is a significant increase in sales. So now, if you're speaking of $300,000 increase in sales, that in itself, again, mightn't tell you much in and of its own, because based on the size of the business and based on the size of the overall amount of sales, $300,000 would be seen as very differently. If you have a business that is generating $100 million in sales per annum, a change of $300,000 is neither here nor there. But if you're looking at the percentage change, for example, which is like 25% increase of the on the sales, that in itself is significant, and it would, and you as an analyst would want to get to the bottom of, okay, what is behind the increase in sales? That is something that you should probably be able to again get from the management discussions and so on. And just to point out, when you're doing financial analysis, it's not, especially from a bank perspective, it's not unusual for you to get in touch with the either the business owners or the auditors preparing the financial statement. If you see something that is worth exploring, and the financial statement you have doesn't give you enough information, because maybe what you have might not have a management discussion, the notes might not be very comprehensive, then generally what we would do is just call up the accountant, or call up the business manager, the owner, the financial secretary, or the financial manager, and ask them to explain certain things on the to us. So I would definitely be curious as to what strategy is being used to increase the level of sales. Now, I would also want to know, okay, what is driving it? So now we have a 25% increase in sales being also accompanied with a 27% increase in the cost of sales. So, well, those two generally go hand in hand, because usually if you're selling more goods, you have to buy more goods to sell. So that is nothing unusual. I still am a little bit curious as to why the cost of goods will increase by a greater percentage, but the percentage is not so significantly higher that I would need to call outside for that, for the reason in the end that any number of things could have caused cost of goods sales to increase by a slightly higher percentage than sales. You could just, for example, just have general inflation, whereas maybe you decided to absorb the increase in the cost of the items as opposed to passing it on to the customers and so on. Maybe by doing that could be one of the reasons why you were able to generate the additional increase in sales and so on, as opposed to maybe a competition that might have made a different decision. So the gross profit, because of the fact that the cost of goods sold increased by a slightly higher ratio than the increase in the sales, the gross profit is 19.7%. Now the gross profit would have gone down slightly in the 2008. It was, we had 455,000 divided by 1498,000, like 32 cents, and then we had 380,000 divided by 12 million, 1.2 million. That is 32%. So it was a slight decrease. It just went down from 42% to 30%. Again, nothing really troubling. Overall, gross profit still increased, which at the end of the day is one of the key things that you would be looking at. Sales increase, gross profit increase, so generally be okay. The operating expenses, selling expenses and general expenses, you'll also see an increase in those. This is not surprising given the increase in sales. For example, if you have a company where you're selling more, you might need to get more sales workers and that type of thing. So salaries and so on could go up as a result. Maybe you have to stay open longer hours, more utilities and so on. So overall, it is quite normal to see an increase in operating expense, a company, an increase in sales and so on. So there's an overall 20%, 21% increase in operating expenses. which is a lower ratio than the increase in sales and so on. So which is good. The net income increased by 19% over the period, that is $14,500. Like I was saying, with the sales increase, if somebody presents a statement that shows a $14,500 increase in anything, it might not appear to be significant or whatever the case might be. But again, it's all relative to the size of the operation and so on. So what will tell you even a bigger story is not the actual dollar increase, but the percentage of the increase from one period to the other. And to me, by any measure, 19% increase in net income is extremely good, and so on. Comparative analysis, like horizontal for the balance sheet, a similar analysis that we just did for the income statement. You know, you would do with the balance sheet. You would look at the change in the item, and you would see, basically, you look to see whether or not those changes making sense for what you see happening, you know, in general. That nothing is unusual, that everything is as you would expect it to be. So specifically, if you're looking at, in this case here, we have a decrease in assets. The first thing I would think of if I see a decrease in total assets, I would just think, like, my mind comes to inflation, increasing inflation. Generally, over time, inflation will reduce the value of long-term assets and so on. So right away, I'm looking at that and I have an idea as to what I should be expecting to see. You know, if I do not see what I am expecting to see, then it raises more questions that I will continue to dig into until I get the answers. So you have an overall reduction in assets, in total assets, but you have an increase in the current assets. Current assets increased by 3.2%, $17,000. Long-term investments decreased by 47%, that is $82,500. The assets, the plant assets, which is where you generally get a lot of depreciation, the long-term one would be amortization, the fixed assets would be the depreciation. This increased by 5.4%. 5.4% seems sort of standard. That is approximately a 20-year life asset. So that in itself can generally, if you look at the notes to the statement, you would probably find that increase is just primarily up to depreciation. There would not likely have been any assets sold or anything. So when I'm looking at that overall thing, the only thing, the primary driver for the reduction in total assets would be the reduction in the long-term investment, $82,500. This is something I would look at again, just to know that, okay, is this some kind of a strategic decision to reduce debt exposure, or is it just one of the instruments that we had matured, and so on. So I will just look at that just to verify. If it is some management strategy, then I will look to see, okay, where is that business heading? What can I expect next and so on? What will be the result of that management decision and so on? And all those different things. On the liability side of things, we're looking at a reduction in the current liabilities, a reduction across the board in current, long term, and overall, obviously. The primarily driven by the reduction again, we had identified the long term liabilities. The current liabilities, the fluctuation in the current liabilities is not unusual. I mean, you get money and you pay money on an ongoing basis, so there is always fluctuations in there. Long-term liabilities, that could be from the normal amortization of the debt, or it could be from a payoff or for the mature or advance in an obligation or something. We already spoke of that, so we don't need to go into that. Overall, stockholders equity, that reduced by $91,000, and stockholders equity increased, by 5%, And that was, in large part, well, solely as a result of the increase in the retained earnings, which is a quality increase, because that was not increased because the owners, for example, decided to take some of their own money and put in or whatever. It was just through, it was like an organic increase, right? From the increase was due to an improvement in the result of the business operations, the net profit that will retain after you pay the dividend and so on. So overall, I don't see anything that would really concern me. I would just still explore the reduction in the long-term investment to see. Looking at that, I could probably just off the face, just say the owners could have liquidated their long-term investment to pay off the long-term liability. It could have been that you have money is being held on an escrow account just to service that obligation when it became due, and so that was done. So you have a more or less corresponding reduction in the long-term investments and the long-term liability. I would just verify it and so on, but nothing alarming on the financial statement. If we're looking at both the income statement that we looked at in the previous slide and the balance sheet for that same business, then generally I would think that the business is a good business, it is profitable, it is growing, and it has a strong enough balance sheet, and so on. It is a business probably I would most likely lend to. The amount is something else for consideration, but no red flag will present it in that business.
So now, before you move on, is it possible for you to put the presentation in full screen?
It is not. I'm sorry. I have two screens here, and it is on a full screen on one of mine. So I am not sure as to how you see it. So tell me, how is it now?
More in an edited view, as opposed to it being in a presentation view.
Okay, let me try something. You should have told me so earlier, man. How is it showing now? How is it showing now?
It's showing better. Thanks.
You're welcome. Let me just do one more thing. It's even better now, right?
Thanks.
Okay. Now we're looking at we continue on our ratio analysis. So ratio analysis is used to evaluate the various aspects of a company's operating and financial performance. Now, these will be liquidity ratios, first and foremost. And it is no coincidence that I put liquidity ratios as the first one. Now, liquidity ratio measure a company's ability to pay off its short-term debt as they come due, using the company's current or quick assets. Liquidity ratios include the current ratio, the quick ratio, and the working capital ratio. It effectively is gonna let you know if this company has enough cash or near cash items or assets on hand that will enable it to service its current liabilities. Is the relationship, the ratio between the current assets and the current liabilities acceptable given the type of business? So this is what the liquidity, when you're doing liquidity ratio analysis, this is what you're going to be looking at. We will look at an example also coming up. Leverage solvency ratios compares a company's debt levels with its assets. equity, sorry, debt levels with assets, equity, and earnings with value where the company can stay afloat in the long term by paying its long-term debt and interest on that debt. Examples of solvency ratios would include the debt-to-equity ratio, the debt-to-asset ratio. So the solvency, so the liquidity ratio is looking at the company's ability in the short term, right, within the next year, within the next few months. Leverage gives you an idea to the company's ability over a longer period in general. It will give you an indication as to the financial risk that the business faces in the long term. The profitability ratios, this show how well a company can generate profits from its operations. And that includes the profitability margin, the return on assets, the return on equity, and so on. We will get, we will do a little bit more of that again with some examples coming up. The efficiency ratios divide the world where the company uses its assets and liabilities to generate sales, maximize profits, and so on. Now, examples of the efficiency ratios are the receivables, the three period, the turnover, the receivables, sorry, the payables, the inventory period, and then we have the cash to cash cycle, which sort of put it all together. We will speak of that in the coming slides. Now, I try to not just, and I try to show you a working example as we're going along, so you kind of appreciate it. But at the same time, keeping it relatively simple for the class, it's a relatively short class. One of the things about it, as I said at the start, because I don't teach all the time, it was, and I didn't have much time to for example, do a full live field run through. It was, I was trying to get back to how in depth I needed to go without expiring the amount of time that I was given to present the class. So we have, for example, about 1 hour that has passed already. It used me for about 45 more minutes. We're looking like we're making good progress, so that should give us enough time for questions and so on. So again, as we're going along, even if, for example, you have questions that might not be directly relating to what's on the slide in front of you, you know, we could discuss those as well and so on. The important thing is that when you're done with the class, you will not have a master capacity in because of that class, but you should have a fair understanding of the material and so on by the time we're done with it. So if you do not feel that you're getting that level of understanding, then feel free to again discuss it. Liquidity ratios. We'll first look at the working capital, like the current assets minus the current liabilities. It's a straight number, it is not a ratio really. It's just a figure. And we're looking to see that this figure is positive. While the acceptable level will vary depending on the number of factors, including the historical level, peer and industry averages, the benchmark is that an acceptable level of working capital should be positive. At the very least, it should not be less than 1-to-1. You know, it shouldn't be zero. It could be close to basically the break-even. Because what the ratio tells us is that we have enough cash and near enough cash items, short-term assets, that will enable us to continue to meet our short-term and current liabilities. When the light bill comes through, we can write a check and the check will not bounce. So we have enough money here to pay our obligations. This is basically a straight number in terms of the working capital. So looking at that figure, we have $80,000 in current assets. We have $40,000 in current liabilities. Working capital is $40,000. That means we have an extra $40,000 on hand. I can take that, looking at that on the face of it, I can take that in two ways. I can take that to mean that the business is very strong, it's very liquid, you know, it has a lot of money available. But at the same time, I could just take it to mean like, is the management making the best use out of, it, of its assets? Does it really need to hold that much current assets in relation to the current liabilities? A lot of that will be answered by the type of business, the sector we're operating in. If we're operating in a very volatile business, one where you could have things spring up when you expectedly, then you would need to have a greater cushion in place, and so on. You could decide to keep extra cash on hand that will allow you to take advantage of some maybe unforeseen or unplanned opportunities, and so on. So that could be one of the reasons for holding twice the amount of current assets to current liabilities. It could also just be that management doesn't have much ideas as to what to do with the assets or the business. So they do not have investing opportunities, for example. Because generally you will find there is a trade-off between the holding current assets to holding non-current assets. The current assets and so on would not generate you often generate a lower revenue, a lower return for you. If you just hold in cash on hand, you have $20,000 in the bank, you will get like the minimal interest rate on that. However, if you probably had to invest more of it, like into some more higher interest generating assets or so on, more investment opportunities, maybe take some of that cash and probably start up another little business or so on, you could probably increase your return overall. But again, for you to be able to do that proper analysis, you would need to look at the type of business, you would look at the sector it's operating in, what is the average for the industry, what is the variability, the and so on in the business and in the sector. Continuing in the same liquidity ratios, we have the current ratio, which is the current asset over the current liability. It's the same information that we were discussing when we were looking at the current. The working capital is just presented differently. Instead of putting one minus the other one, we have one over the other one. So current ratio of 2. Current ratio of 2 doesn't tell you much if you don't have a standard or benchmark to compare it again. For example, in most banks, you will get to qualify to be regarded as an acceptable liquidity, you need to have a minimum ratio of 1.5. That means like the current ratio, you would have 1.5 times current assets over your liabilities. That will give you generally anybody to be able to service your current liabilities by still giving you a buffer that will allow you to take advantage of any opportunities or meet any unexpected obligations. Because as an example, I'm just saying like you could have some long-term obligation, but for some reason or the other, the person might choose to call it on you prematurely, and so on. And if there is a clause that allowing them to do that, and you might need to have the extra money in hand to be able to service that debt, even if you don't expect it to happen. So anyway, the current ratio in that situation would be a ratio of 2. It tells you the same information as the working capital. The quick ratio gives you a slightly different picture, because what it really does is looking at the most liquid asset over the same level of current liabilities. It removes the inventories from the equation. The reason we're looking at the quick ratio is because we have inventory on hand. It's going to take us some time, first of all, to sell the inventory. And if we generally sell on credit, as that company does, because they have $15,000 in receivables, it's gonna take you some more time again to collect on all the sales. So you're not going, you probably have to wait a month or two or three before you can actually turn that inventory into cash that can be actually used to pay debt to service your short-term liabilities. So because of that, like, delay, you want to be able to analyze, okay, as much as possible, if somebody comes calling today, can you pay them today? Because you might not always have the luxury to be able to plan 3 months ahead to be able to submit everything. And so the quick ratio does that. It's also called the acid test ratio. So it looks at the most liquid, the most stressed situation in assessing liquidity. It would be best if the ratio is at least one. For all the liquidity ratios, at least one would be preferred. But it is not unusual to see a quick ratio of less than one. And it is not alarming either, especially based on the sector or the type of business again you're operating in. Because usually you would have some time to sell out some of that venture as well. So in this case, the quick ratio, although we had some very strong parent ratio of 2, the quick ratio here is 0.88 because the highest element in the current asset is, in fact, inventories is more than twice the cash on hand and so on. So that is why you have such a large difference between the current ratio and the quick ratio in this situation. But I would not really be alarmed by that, despite the fact that the quick ratio in itself is less than that. We now move on to the, anybody have any questions on liquidity ratios and so on, the liquidity analysis? If not, we'll now move on to the leverage solvency ratios. The first one we're looking at is the debt to equity ratio. And so this looks at the financing structure of the business. Okay, the debt to equity ratio indicates how much debt a company is using to finance its assets relative to the value of shareholders' equity. Generally, the lower the debt ratio, the greater or stronger is the financial position of the business. A ratio of 1:1 would generally be good leverage. Beyond 3:1 would be worried in most industries, except for me. I said except financial, where higher leverage is normal. It's not even the exception. I should have put an example here instead of except. Sorry. So I will edit that to put example. As we in the financial sector, so we know, for example, the Basel standard is 8% capital ratio, which translates to like a 92% in terms of debt ratio. So in the financial world and so on, we usually operate with much higher leverage than, for example, a trading company, primarily because, for example, all our deposits are regarded as liabilities and so on. So the debt ratio is usually higher for financial institutions. Now, the debt ratio indicates how much of a debt a company is using to finance its assets relative to the equity. So, the lower the debt ratio, the better position the company is in. Again, you still have to look at it in relation to its peers, to the industry, to the regulatory standards, and so on, to know what level of debt to equity ratio is acceptable and so on. In this case here, we have total debt of $15,000 and we have total equity of $10,000. So we have a 1.5 times ratio, which is good by most standards and so on. The debt to asset ratio basically gives you the same information as the previous slide, it just presents it differently. Total debt to total assets, 0.6 in this case here. If you want to just work out the relationship between the 1.5 and the 0.6, you could just do 1.5, 1 divided by the 1.5, and you get the 0.6, which is the same thing. Okay. So it tells you that generally, when you, but in one at a glance, the advantage of that one is at a glance, you can just see that 60% of your assets is financed with debt. Just looking at that one ratio here. And for in the Caribbean, we usually use higher debt and financing than most developed countries. And that is in large part due to the fact that we don't have strong security markets and so on. So there are not a lot of opportunities for small business people or business people in general to get equity financing through just general shareholders and so on. It is not part of our culture. Generally, if you have a business and you want to raise capital, you go to a bank and you ask for a loan. It is not in our culture to first of all like ask family members to come up with the money we need or issue a debt security to on the market an equity security in the market to raise capital. So we have slightly higher leverage, debt leverage ratios than would be elsewhere. I can tell you right now, for example, that the average business coming to ask for a loan here in Dominica would have a debt ratio that is greater than 60%. Greater than that, you would probably get something closer to 90%. To put that in normal sense, if you come in and you need $1 million to set up a business, you would, the 90% debt ratio means that the business is $900,000 of that $1 million that you need is from a loan. Now, what does that tell you? That tells you that the business has significant financial risk. If you have to compare that with another business, let's just say that you have equity or you only have debt of $500,000. Now, if you have to look at the difference between those two businesses, you have the same, let's just say, you have the same business structure, same business model, same industry, everything. One is financed with $900,000 debt. The other one is financed with $500,000 debt. Now, at the end of the month, that person that has the $900,000 loan is going to have to come up with, let's just say, $90,000 loan payment. Well, I shouldn't say 90 is a bit harsh. That would be a very short term loan. And so on. So it depending on how long you have the loan for, but straight calculation, if you're looking at a loan over 10 years, then you see $100,000 a year, you probably have to add some interest to that, and so on. So you're probably looking at, let's say, $12,000 a month on the $900,000 loan. Now, if you have a business that you just started up, now, as opposed to the other business, probably where you might have to pay about $7,000 or so a month, the $5,000 difference could be the difference between survival and failure for those two businesses. So while they would both have the same business and they would both be serving the same market and having the same product and everything like that, the financing structure alone would be the difference between one of those businesses succeeding and the other one failing. The higher leverage, the higher financial risk, the higher the business probability of the lower the business probability of succeeding. If you cannot afford to pay that $12,000, then the bank is going to foreclose on you. It's going to take over whatever assets that you pledge as security, and it's going to effectively shut down your operation. So that is one path. That is one way to look at it. So in general, the lower the debt ratio, the stronger the business, the lower the financial risk for the business. The other way to also look at it though is that the reason we're in business is to maximize the return to our shareholders. Our shareholders contribute equity into the business. In that case, they contributed $10 million equity. Now, you would have to pay, on average, if you're looking at the stock exchange, for example, equity generates a return on average of about 40% over the long term. Generally, if you're getting a return on the securities market of less than 10%, it's not so good in the long term. So equity is more or less an expensive source of financing. Investors expect a strong return on their investment. As opposed to, like, for example, a bank loan. where you might be paying 5% interest on the capital. So what you could find now, what you will generally find is debt financing is a cheaper source of financing than equity financing that is in a normally functioning market. So it, you can reduce the overall cost of capital by increasing the amount of debt compared to equity, and at the same time, by using the debt in the capital structure, you're increasing the size of the business beyond what the shareholders themselves can finance, which should lead to greater sales, greater actual profits, and so on, and then ultimately a greater return on the shareholders. So in choosing the capital structure for a business, you have to weigh in between those two choices, ensuring that the business is not overly leveraged and incurring and is subject to too much financial risk, whilst at the same time having enough debt in the business so that you can leverage, you can increase the return that you're going to be generating for your shareholders. You'll be able to get a bigger business if you augment the shareholders' capital with some debt capital and so on. So this is a decision that the CFO and so on might or the business will have to make in terms of the appropriate level of and the appropriate capital structure and so on. When you do the financial analysis, you have to understand those dynamics and so on. You have to look at the industry averages and so on. And that is why it's important not to just look at those numbers in isolation and so on. Because lower is not always better and in every situation. Profitability ratios. Now we are the gross margin, the operating margin, and the net profit margin. Now there are some of the more popular means of assessing a business's ability to generate earnings relative to their expenses. For most of these ratios, having a higher ratio relative to a competitor, well, for all of them, having a higher ratio relative to a competitor or to the industry means that the business is doing very good, it's doing well. It's exceeding the average. And so if you have a higher gross margin, that means you're generally keeping your cost of sales lower than your competition. More of your money staying into the business. Operating margin, a strong operating margin means then generally controlling expenses better than your peers and so on. Or you're generating more revenue for the same expenses. So you're operating more efficiently in that regard and so on. The higher the net profit margin, well, that is the final indicator. The higher net profit margin is the ultimately the better off your shareholders are going to be. And so on. You would be able to pay a good dividend while still being able to keep enough money to continue to grow the business and so on, as opposed to your peers. Conversely, if your ratios are below the industry averages, then you might look into say, okay, what can you improve on? And where are we falling short as opposed to the rest of the industry and so on. So the profitability ratio is generally when you open up an income statement, a financial statement, like for me, whenever I pick it up, it's always the first thing I'm looking at is, okay, the net profit to see whether or not it's positive or negative. Every time I see the number negative, I get depressed because that one line just tells me, okay, no matter what else, this year was that year I'm looking at was not a successful year for the business in general and so on. But then you get deeper into it and you could get very understandable and very varied reasons for the loss, and you could know the important thing is to believe that the losses will not be pervasive, they will not continue into the medium and long term, that you have in place a strategy and so on that will reverse the losses in the near term and so on. looking at profitability ratios, we have first of all the gross profit, which is the gross margin, sorry, which is the gross profit over sales. And here we have this example, 1987 over 11892, 17% gross margin. Similarly, we have the operating expenses, 752, and that's in thousands, over 11892, operating margin of 6%. Now, we went from a gross margin of 17% to an operating margin of 6%. So the in between there would have been the operating expenses and so on that the business incurred. In that situation there, we have all the salaries, general administration, the overheads, and all those different things would have been taken care of. The net margin falls further to 3%. The net margin would have come for interest expense, depreciation, and so on. That is added on to the other expenses and marketing expenses. It is normal, obviously, for us to see we're going from gross operating to net, that the ratio keeps going down and down. The important thing, again, like I said, is to look at those ratios relative to the industry, relative to the peers, and relative to the business's own internal targets and so on. You look at them, the history of those ratios. What was the net margin over the past 3 years and so on? Is the 3% an improvement? Is it average? Is it a reduction in performance and so on? Because on its own, 3% does not appear to be that strong. But if you're operating in a very competitive sector where the average business is not able to generate 3%, if, for example, you're in the bank and you're able to generate consistently a 3% return on the assets, you'll be doing very well as a bank. Because if you have a bank operating $1 billion, in assets, managing generating $1 billion, you have a loan portfolio of $1 billion, and you can generate revenue, and you can generate 3% on that, you would be looking at $30 million in profit for the year. Now, if you have some big manufacturing company and so on, or maybe if you're looking at Microsoft or that type of company, 3% might not be so attractive. So again, it depends on the sector and the expectations for that particular sector, that we will see how good or bad or average those ratios are. Or the profitability, looking at the return on assets and the return on equity. The return on assets refers to the net profit to average total assets. Now, before I continue, the reason why I separated those ratios from these is because these ratios here comparing income statement information to other income statement information. So we have gross profit, two things, both of them appear on the income statement and so on. So it's a direct one over the other. When you're looking at the ratios where you compare the income statement information against balance sheet information, it's a bit different. Because, as we said at the beginning, whilst you have the income statement representing the performance over a period, the balance sheet represents this position at a particular time. So it is kind of a mismatch to compare a performance over a period with just a position at a particular point in time. They might result in very misleading information. So what we do when we're looking at ratios where we have to compare income statement information against the balance sheet information, we take an average for the balance sheet information. So we're looking at the balance, the balance at the beginning of the period, add it to the balance at the end of the period, and we get the average for those two. So generally, we're hoping that it gives a better picture as to what the business's average position would have been like over the period that that corresponds with the financial statement information we compare it with. Sorry, let me just remove that. Okay, so the return on assets, that is the net income to the average total assets. So that is the expectation is that the more assets the company has amassed, and the more sales and potentially more profit the company can generate. If you're getting a consistent return on assets of 2%, the more assets you have, the more actual profits you're going to be generating if you're maintaining that 2%. However, as economies of scale has lowered the unit cost and therefore improved margins, the rate of return might grow even faster than what would be represented by just this straight increase in assets. And we understand what is economies of scale, for example, but that is up to a certain point. Yeah? As you continue to get more assets and so on, you get more efficient in your operations and that type of thing. And so then you should be able to generate more money per every dollar of assets you have invested. The return on equity refers to the net profit to the average shareholder's equity. And it's primarily concerning to the equity holders, since this is what we're really looking at, because you have $10,000 and you're looking to invest it. You can choose to put it in a savings account and get 2% every year on that $10,000. You can invest it in the securities market and get 5% on some bonds and so on. You can put it into a small business and generate 10%. So whatever the case might be, you're going to look to see where you can invest that $10,000 to give you the highest return relative to the risk of that investment. So this is a decision that is very important to the equity investors and the equity holders of the businesses, the return on the equity as well. Okay, international investors will look to match the long-term return on the S&P 500 of approximately 14%. I was explaining that earlier. Generally, a return of less than 10%. That is not by our standard. In truth, in the Caribbean, particularly in Dominica, if you can generate 10% return on your equity, you're doing great. We have an example here where we have the ROA net income over average total assets. In this case, we have net income of 6833. And then the opening and the closing assets. As of 2017, the opening balance would have been 66180. So we add that to the 72.45 and we divide that by 2. We get an average of 69293. So we have an ROA of 9.9%, which, according to the slide we just looked at, is at the bottom area of what would generally be acceptable to attract investors in most developed countries. The return on equity similarly here is 15.9%, when I was comparing that to the previous slide, I kind of just momentarily confused. The 15.9% we're looking at, which is the return on the equity, That ratio is above the 14% average return on the long term return on the S&P 500. So that would be what would be you consider to be a very attractive investment, providing that the risk of that business, the risk, is acceptable. As you will know, in investing, you have to always weigh between risk and return. You have that trade off between risk and return, and so. So even then, if you do an analysis, it's not just enough to say, okay, this is a higher ROE, so this is where I'm going. You need to look beyond that. Efficiency ratios.
So, Pena, just before you move on,
yes, sir.
Could you just go back to the previous slide 1 second, please? So in this case, if we are given the total assets, we are required to calculate the average total assets in order to calculate the return on assets ratio.
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'll just clarify now. Thank you.
Just one thing to that is, if the business is a new business, I only presented in 1 year balance sheet information, that equation would not be possible. You'll be able to calculate average. You just have to go with the 1 year that you have. So in that case, it would just be net income over total assets. In that situation, it would not be as strong as a representative as getting the average, but it will still give you useful information. But the standard formula is to use the average of the balance sheet item when you're doing that analysis. Okay? Now, the efficiency ratios typically used to analyze how effectively a company manages its assets and its liabilities internally in the short term. So we have the inventory turnover. We briefly talked on that earlier. The inventory, the receivables, the payables, turnover period. The inventory is the cost of goods sold on the average inventory. It measures the company's ability to manage inventory efficiently. The higher the ratio, the greater the efficiency. The inventory turnover ratio effectively tells us how many times. Let's just say you have a small supermarket. You carry $50,000 worth of inventory on average in the supermarket. How many times are you going to turn that around in 1 year? How many times are you going to effectively sell off everything you have over a year period? So you're going to sell off the entire $50,000 in inventory, replace it, sell it off again, replace it, sell it off again. So this is what the inventory turnover effectively tells us. The receivables turnover, when we sell, we do not always sell on cash. We often sell on credit. Now it's going to tell you how, on average, how long it takes you to collect your receivables. So if you have $20,000 out there being owing from sales, how long it's going to take you to collect that $20,000, sell more items, have another $20,000 owing, collect it again. It doesn't go clean like that, obviously. It's an ongoing cycle, but this is effectively what the ratio tells you. So how many times you're going to be able to collect, how long it's going to take you to, how many times it's going to take to collect on the amount of money you have out there. How efficient is your collection system? Now, the payables tells you, on average, how long it's taking you to pay off your own obligation. So it purchases over the average payables. Just as a side note, we have purchases here. A lot of times we can't use cost of goods sold. If you have enough information, like the balance sheet information, to get opening and closing inventory, and then you would have the cost of sales on the income statement, you can calculate, you can extract the purchases from that. You're not always, well, you're hardly ever given a purchases number on the income statement, but you can get that information if you know the cost of goods is called the opening inventory plus purchases minus closing inventory equation, then you'll be able to get purchases using that formula. So that would be the purchases over the average payable to know on average how long you'll be taking it to service your obligation. Generally, you do not want it to be too long or too short, because a very long payables period would suggest that the person is unable to service the debt in a timely enough manner, and by thought they could be alienating frustrated. If they get some of their goods on credit, and they're given a 30 days period to repay that credit, a payable period beyond the 30 days might limit their ability to get more credit in the future, and so on. But at the same time, now if you're effectively managing your working capital resources, you would want them to use up the credit because it is effectively a free source of lending. In the absence of that credit period, they might have to use an overdraft facility or something. Because generally, you buy stock, you have to keep the stock on hand over a period of time before you can sell that stock. You're selling that stock over time. So the stock that you have there on hand, the cash is not yet readily available for it to pay off the supplier. So something like that, if you have to look at the specifics of it. So again, you will look at the average of those ratios for the type of business and for the industry to know whether or not the person is operating in good enough ratios. Time running out. I think we need to try to speed up slightly. Now, these are examples of using the inventory turnover. We have the cost of goods over the average inventory. In that case, here we have 4.4 times. So that tells you that in a year, the person is unable to turn over that their inventory 4.5 times. So, and then you can use that to get the inventory period, which is the predictable by the number of times and the turnover period. And then you get 83 days. So 83 days to turn over your inventory. If that goes to a supermarket, I would probably consider that to be a bit lengthy. The person might not be effectively managing their inventory. They might be stocking too many slow moving items. So that is one way, for example, the person might be able to increase efficiency by maybe reducing the amount of items, the slow moving items they have on hand, and increasing the more quicker moving items. For a supermarket, for example, I would like to see a turnover period, an inventory period of about 40 days or less, and so on. So that is something I would look at. The receivables period, we have 7.8 days there. That is not very long. I would say that person operating mostly on a cash basis. They do not give a lot of credit. There is probably some credit to the government for recent, something very short term. 1 week effectively is not a long time. Likewise, we say the person is paid their debt relatively quickly. They get the money, they use it, they pay their debt. Because you have effectively the same kind of a time frame between the receivables and the payable period there. The cash to cash cycle, as I mentioned, it puts it all together. So it adds, so we have the inventory period plus the receivables period minus the payables period. What that tells you is if you put $1 into the business, how long is it going to take you to use that dollar to buy stock, sell stock, collect your money to get back that dollar into the business? So it's the cycle of the cash in the business. And that, and in this case, yeah, it takes about 83 days. Again, it's all relative. You have to look at the industry averages. You have to look at the liquidity position of the company and so on to know whether or not that should be improved or if it's a good place to be. Limitations of financial statement analysis, there's a couple of them we have here. Differences in the accounting methods could distort financial reports. As we know, there are updates to the IFRS standards and so on, and then sometimes you have options of various accounting principles that you could employ, and so on. So if you could change one of them just to probably make the information on the balance sheet or so on appear better than they would be, even if there was no real change in the company's performance. Comparative information may not be suitable when a firm operates in multiple sectors. If you have a large conglomerate, you probably have a car dealership here, a supermarket there, you probably have a little fast cash place there. You're not going to get ratios that you can compare with any one sector. So you might not be able to get any really industry or comparative ratios to assess performance again. And even if, for example, even if your ratios in general might be better than the average or at the industry average. The whole industry average could be four. So that doesn't in itself mean that the business is good because they are at all above the industry average and so on. One more thing I wanted to add there though is also we need to bear in mind the ability for accountants to manipulate various items. So as if, for example, as we were saying that the balance sheet presents the position of the business at a particular point in time, December 31st, that is how the business looks. But by the 3rd of December, the business could look very differently. Yes, and the owner of the business, for example, could have taken some of his own money and dropped on the business's account just to improve liquidity, you know, improve the overall leverage and position. And by the following week, take back his money, you know, and then the business actual ongoing liquidity position would not be represented by the balance sheet and so on. So there's different limitations of the whole analysis. And that takes us directly to 12:15. So that is the end of the class. I don't know if anybody have any questions or if we have any more time for anything else.
Darren, is that the conclusion of your presentation?
It is.
Yes, okay.
That's perfect timing, right?
Yes, it seems. Okay, so Avon is over to you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Pinard, for your presentation.
You're welcome.
I have a question for Mr. Pinard. For the purpose of the examination, will we be asked to prepare an income and balance sheet statement?
Not prepare, but to assess, analyze.
Okay.
More than likely, you will be given a couple of extracts, not percentage and so on. But you would need to, if you look at the material that was covered here today, and you understand it and so on, then you should be okay.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions?
To be provided with formulas for the exam?
No.
Any more questions?
That's it.
All right. Then, if you have no more questions, thank you, Mr. Pinard, for your presentation, and folks, we are going to break now for lunch.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
You're welcome. Bye. So we're going to break now for lunch, and we would resume our afternoon session with the basics of equity and bond markets, and this the presenter for that session would be Mr. Stephen Thomas. So I'll see you back here at 2, or at least 10 minutes before to sign in. All right? Have a good lunch.
Thank you.